Ads, schmads. If you don't want ads, that's okay. Choose the Dave McWilliams Plus option on Apple Podcasts. And hey presto, no ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
John, a very interesting fact that I discovered this morning.
Yeah.
That Eliza Notaro, our fantastic researcher and all-around person who keeps this podcast together, is Phil Lynott's cousin.
No way.
Now,
no
way. Eliza's granny and Phil Lynott's ma are sisters.
Wow. Now, that's a claim to it. That's rock and roll royalty.
We are right in, there. We are in the presence of rock and roll aristocracy, and don't you forget it. Don't you forget it.
That's
now,
brilliant. That really
is good. It's one of the best. I was telling her that when years ago, I ended up in Prague, but in the company of a biker gang from Dresden.
Right.
And this was in 1988, before the wall came down, right?
Yeah.
And I found myself in a boozer in Prague, and I befriended these Germans, but they really befriended me on the basis that the only cassettes they had, the biker gang, were Thin Lizzy Live and Dangerous cassettes. And I was from Dublin, and therefore I was golden for them. So big shout out to the...
In fact, if I remember correctly, Live and Dangerous, what's the name of that song? Was our first slow set. Not you and I's first slow
John,
set.
John, is there something you'd like to admit to the podcast audience?
But
John asked me up to dance. He said, do you come here often?
Oh God, that came out all wrong.
Do you like hard sums and some other great one-liners? Anyway, it is lovely to talk to you all on this Easter, the tail end of Easter. We have a special podcast for you today, which is on Sam Bankman-Fried. You will know Sam Bankman-Fried was jailed for 25 years for fraud, one of the longest sentences ever delivered to a white-collar criminal. And the backdrop, of course, is the world of crypto, FTX. Mm. Basically, in a nutshell, what Bankman-Fried did was he took investors' money who had given him money on his crypto exchange, and he used that money, which should have been ring-fenced and untouched, and he used that money to buy assets for his hedge fund, Alameda Research. And then all those assets were crypto-related, and in the big crypto crash of 18 months ago, all those assets collapsed in value. There were then margin calls where people said, can I have my money back, please, from the exchange?
Yeah.
And suddenly there was
no
money
in
the exchange.
Gives your ball back, mister.
Yeah, exactly. Gives your ball back, exactly. I'll never do that for you. And there was no money left. And
it was 10 billion that went missing, wasn't it?
A trivial sum, John, a trifling 10 million. And of course, but the interesting podcast we have here today is a conversation I had with the wonderful, wonderful Michael Lewis. He of Moneyball, The Big Short, Liar's Poker, one of the great American chroniclers finance, the economy, etc. I sat down with Michael Lewis. We are going to give you an edited version of this conversation. If you want...
Been slugging away on this with my razor blades.
Yes, just been snipping away. But if you want, the full version of this will be up on Patreon. It is an hour-long conversation. It's absolute gold. We're going to give you the abridged version here. Mm. But if you want to hear the whole thing of myself and Michael Lewis talking about Sam Bankman-Fried based on his book, Going Infinite, check us out on patreon.com/David McWilliams. Now, John, how we started this, I just kicked off by asking Lewis, like, what was he like? What was Bankman-Fried like? And so let's just listen and see what he made of him.
Part of what intrigued me was his social manner, his affect. He didn't give any indication of knowing anything about me. And in fact, in the year and a half I spent with him, he asked me not a single question about myself. I found out from his parents that when he was a boy, when he was 10, 11, 12, he was very out of this very isolated childhood. He was a kind of a nerd among nerds. He had no friends. He lived in his head. I mean, there were pathologies that were really curious about him. Born without a natural complement of human feeling, very attracted to sort of trying to turn the world into a math problem. He had somehow stumbled upon my book, Moneyball, which is, you know, turning the business of evaluating sports and sports strategies into a math problem. And he had fantasized about one day being running a baseball team for a couple of years of his life. And the book had meant a lot to him. He himself never mentioned it. So I got the sense that I was just like another grown-up to him.
Because it's fascinating, the books, he's so open to you.
Yes. So I think he had a purpose for me in the very beginning. And there was the feeling about him, this sounds more off-putting than it actually was in person. But because he was very self-consciously turning every decision into an expected value calculation, every decision was devoid of feeling and was processed, you know, however problematically, through these quantitative gears in his head, that I could see, you could see him calculating, like, what's the purpose of, like, having me in his life? And I concluded that in the beginning, what he thought was, well, he was at that moment trying to legitimize crypto, and especially FTX, his exchange. And ironically, given what happened, that he was regarded as the acceptable face of crypto, that he was trying to get licensed in all these countries. I mean, the first opening scene of the book. So by this time, I've spent enough time with him, I'm invisible with Sam. Now I've gotten myself in a position where Sam Bankman-Fried, where when I say, could I just hang, I just be in the background, he doesn't even think about it. We are in Los Angeles. I gotta tell the whole story. We're in Los Angeles. We were there for the Super Bowl. So early February of last year. And we get to Los Angeles and the Super Bowl attracts basically global celebrity. It's amazing who turns up for this thing because all eyes are on it. And he's got all these invitations to do this and that. And I'm just watching him trying to figure out what he's going to do. And he says, there's this party in Beverly Hills. I don't know the guy who's hosting it, but he says there's going to be a lot of famous people there. It might be kind of fun. And he didn't know how to pronounce the name of the person who invited him. He didn't have any idea who he was. His coworkers lived in peril that Sam was going to be kidnapped by, like, the Russian mafia because crypto was such a good ransom. So they follow him to this house, wait outside in case this is what's going to happen in this house. We walk into the house, into the garden, and there's 60 people there. And it's Hillary Clinton, Chris Rock, Leo DiCaprio, Katy Perry, Kate Hudson, three owners of NFL football teams, four Kardashians. That's a
lot of Kardashians.
That's a lot of Kardashians. It was, everybody was famous. And by the end of the night, everybody was around Sam just wanting to hear what he had to say. He had the crowd mesmerized. This way you saw what the effect of a big pile of money. So next day, he says, we're about to leave. He says, I got some Zoom with someone I've never heard of. I don't know what she wants. And I said, could I just watch? And he said, sure, just come on in. So I sit off to the side of his computer. We in his hotel room. He flips up the screen and it's Anna Wintour, Devil Wears Prada, editor of Vogue magazine. He doesn't know any of that. And I watch for 45 minutes as she tries to get this schlub in a t-shirt and shorts to pay for the Met Gala, for the most prominent fashion event in the world, and that she supervises. And he's already lost the sense of being watched by me. He's just doing what he normally does. And she comes on the screen and starts to pitch him. And he goes into full Sam Bankman-Fried mode. She comes on the screen, he hits a button, screen goes dark, and up pops a video game. And while she's talking, he's playing the video game. And he's making noises, yup, it's interesting. He's making it sound like he's listening to her. And meanwhile, like, there's this dragon attacking this minotaur and blood is all over the place and these trees with hatchets that come onto the screen. And she's talking about the Met Gala. Then she says, what do you know about the Met Gala? And he goes, oh, I know some things. Hits a button. The Wikipedia page for Met Gala comes up. And he's cribbing as he goes along. And he's going, and he's giving her as little as possible so he can go back to playing his video when he's talking to her. Already at that point, he got to the point with me where he wasn't thinking, I think he's thinking, like, whatever he sees, it doesn't matter. And what he was showing me, and I saw this over and over, is that he occupied at every moment, kind of needed to occupy more than one reality. He had to be doing something else, usually in some fantasy world, at the same time he's functioning in the real world. And you only get those moments, you only get those scenes if you become wallpaper. If they think you're interviewing them, or they think, or they don't trust your motives, or they think you're dumb, or they think you're boring, they won't let you. They won't let you get to that place. You have to get to that place where you can see those.
And you're just stepping right back, and you're almost invisible.
You hope they forget you're there. That's right.
So let's talk about the book. Is structured the way there's a lot of stuff in his childhood. There's amazing quotes about people interpreting his childhood, saying that Sam was waiting for his childhood to be over.
Like so he could talk to people.
Yeah. So he kind of didn't get this whole childhood. And then, because I want to get to how this character we're describing made and lost so much money and the background to the whole thing. How does he end up trading at all?
It's a really great question. So you, just a tiny little sketch of the child. The child is socially awkward, doesn't capture it. Socially isolated, an extraordinary way, given that he comes from a family that's together and is actually kind of a social hub on the Stanford campus. Both his parents are professors at the Stanford Law School. And I ask him, give me a list of the people who knew you before the age of 18 who can tell me something about you. He said, I guess my parents. And I said, anybody else? He goes, there's nobody. And this proved to be mostly true. Whatever he had went undiagnosed. But what he had was a feeling at a pretty early age, he didn't feel the things other people felt. He didn't feel pleasure. He didn't feel love. He didn't feel empathy. And he knew he didn't feel empathy. There were things he couldn't do that people normally do in order just to, that are the foundations of social interaction. He couldn't make facial expressions. It's not till he's 20 that he learns how to like make his face smile when someone says something. He's odd. And at the same time, he's so isolated, he has a story about himself, but it's a kind of nebulous story. He's smarter than his classmates. He's the best student in his class. But it only gets him so far, because it emerges at about the age of 12 or 13, he's pretty gifted with math, but he's not that gifted with math. He goes to a math camp, and the kids who are at math camp are better than him. He's good at chess, but he's not that good at chess. He can beat everybody in his high school in chess, but he goes to a chess tournament, and he's just okay. It's not until he's at MIT as a student and collides with Wall Street that he figures out what, or thinks he figures out what makes him special, why it's okay that nobody's really loved him, nobody's really appreciated him, nobody's really identified a place in the world he belongs, because now he's found it. And the way this happens, this is a very contemporary story. While it's true that even back in my day, you know, the Liar's Poker story is partly the story of the intellectualization of Wall Street, of a different kind of brain coming into the financial markets. Up until quite recently, people had to pass through social filters to get into prominent positions or get into the markets. And what happens on the back end of the financial crisis is many financial markets and all the big ones get automated, so that you are no longer trading face-to-face. You're no longer in trading pits. You no longer have to interface with people at all. It's all automated, it's all computerized, and it is algorithmic trading. It's hitting a button. It's playing a video game. It's a gamification of finance. And the social demands drop to almost zero. And at that point, these firms that sit in the middle of the automated markets, and they're the firms where the most money is made now, it's no longer the banks you think sit in the middle of the market. It's not Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley. It's Citadel. It's Virtu. It's Jump Trading. It's the firm that discovers Sam at MIT, Jane Street. And these firms, by the time they find Sam in 2012, they've already kind of built a pipeline to turn math people into money people. People who might have in any other era become high school physics teachers or college professors.
Yes.
They're being pulled into finance.
This is a deep change in finance.
It's a deep change in finance. And you could even see it, Sam said, when you walked onto the Jane Street trading floor. Jane Street had been founded by old pit traders, people who had been come of age in the 90s to early 2000s. And he said you could see a physical change in the person, that the older people were bigger, they had louder voices, they had a presence, they were more sociable. The younger people were more shriveled, less social, weirder, and also had an aptitude for higher order thinking. They were smarter. And I think it's
smarter
in a narrow way.
So we're talking about the finance becoming the preserve of a narrower and narrower, arguably emotional intelligence base.
The emotional intelligence is you're no longer filtered for it.
Right.
So Sam has zero of it. But what he has is the interview process to get into one of these firms would be alien to anybody who interviewed for a job on Wall Street 20 years before. They put you through a series of essentially games. And the games are messy games, wicked games, essentially betting games, where there's no right answer, there are only wrong answers. And the trick in these games is to be able to quickly quantify things that are hard to quantify, quickly decide, and quickly see kind of expected value calculations and not lose a perspective on the game. So what Sam has realized, around this time is that he's not the best at chess. However, if you change chess and you make it speed chess and you have to make your move in 5 seconds, plus you change the rules every 2 minutes. So every 2 minutes, someone shouts, for the next 5 minutes, queens or pawns.
Yeah.
Or for the next 5 minutes, the rooks or knights. And that in that situation, he adapts very quickly, moves faster than other people, is willing to make the decisions and triumphs. That's essentially describing the skill that Jane Street is looking for.
And now, why is it looking for this skill?
Because what they're doing, the decisions that are required on the trading floor are very fast decisions. And they don't have to be right all the time. They just have to be systematically. The human beings who work on the Jane Street trading floor have to be like little weighted coins. They have to come up heads 51% of the time. And you have 200 of them across the floor, the law of large numbers, they'll win. And the worst thing is someone who's paralyzed by the lack of a right answer, or the person who can't see how you quantify the thing and make some rough expected value judgment. But this is the mind that they're looking for. And in Sam Bankman-Fried, not just this firm, but other firms, are sufficiently blown away that, well, one of the firms that is in trying to hire him says that they just stopped the interview process halfway through and said, you're the best we've seen, in some years, and the job's yours if you want it. Now, what this does to him, it's one of the forces that creates him. He persuades him he's special in this way, that he knows how to take risk. It's not true that he knows how to take risks.
We know that.
What I loved about the story, what I loved about him as a character, was where he took you. He took you into modern Wall Street. He gave you a chance to see how modern Wall Street worked. And he took you to this other great land where we kind of shaped him. And it's the land of effective altruism. It's like the mathification of how you live your life in this philosophy.
So this effective altruism, explain that to me.
So you can't understand how weird this story is unless you accept he was sincere about this. It's not an excuse. It's not like, that means you get to not go to jail. But this is the weirdness of the story. What this person thinks they're doing when they're doing what they're doing. And this movement, effective altruism, this is a movement that starts, like Bitcoin, on the back end of the financial crisis. A lot is happening in 2008. But these philosophers in Oxford start to make an argument. It's sort of extending a strain of utilitarianism, the greatest good for the greatest number. And they make an argument that people should rethink their philanthropic obligations, that it is an obligation, it's a duty if you start to frame it the way they frame it.
So it's kind of like a cross between Jesus Christ and Gordon Gekko.
this is where Gordon Gekko walks in. What's interesting about this movement, it has cult-like qualities, but it's a kind of anti-cult because it is rooted in a kind of in reason, in an argument. They go out to kids and they say, we're thinking about what they're going to do with their lives. And they say, if you're thinking about this movement and you're thinking about maximizing your benefit to humanity, you might think, go be a doctor and go save lives in Africa.
Yeah.
Or the choice is, if you're of interest to Wall Street, go to Wall Street and make so much money you can send 20 doctors to Africa. And this becomes a siren call for Sam Bankman-Fried. It's sort of like, I'm going to go make as much money as possible to give as much money away as possible.
Or in his case, I'm going to lose as much money as possible.
Well, in the beginning, it's make.
Right. So you really think, Michael, that this is not a clever con man who's coming up with a shtick because he's on trial and he's saying, this is why I did it.
Oh, no, no,
you
no,
think
no,
this
no.
is very deep in him.
It's very deep in him. This does not excuse him.
No, but it's a motivational force.
But his whole crowd, that firm, was run by these people who believe this. To their core, it was who they were. It was where they found their identity when they're 21 years old. And that Sam's grandiose ambition expresses itself by wanting to be the person who's the most important person in effective right. altruism. And he quickly becomes the face of effective altruism. So what I love about this story is all the ambiguity and the nuance is that you can condemn him, and I wouldn't blame you. But I do believe this, that he doesn't get where he gets and doesn't have the desire to do what he does unless he first has this ambition, this effective altruist thing going on.
So it's real. So he's been driven by, let's say, a mission, a rather higher mission, that seems to favor kids who are very good at maths, this type of brain, effective altruism. So how does he say, okay, I'm working in Jane Street, I'm making money, I'm a good trader, but this isn't making the shekel for me. This isn't really moving the needle. I'm going to do something else. And that's something else. I've just found this thing called crypto. He says in the book, well, I don't really know what it is, but it seems to me that the market in crypto is so inefficient that my talent that has just been recognized now at Jane could actually allow me to make a fortune here. This is the thought process. And that fortune then I'm going to spend in this altruistic way.
Yeah.
So explain to me how he does this. Because this is the fascinating thing. He does it so quickly.
So just a beat more inside of Jane Street. So think about this. This kid, no one has appreciated him his entire life. This Wall Street firm, which is promising to pay him tens of millions of dollars a year down the road if he just stays and keeps doing what he's doing, has done nothing but shower kind of love on him. And this is really revealing about how these firms work and also about Sam Bankman-Fried. Going into the election of 2016, and this is kind of the turning point with him, I think. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump dueling it out. And for the weeks running up to the election, whenever there's news about Trump that looks good for Trump, the markets, stock markets tank all over the world. And the opposite with Hillary Clinton. So a handful of Jane Street traders, Sam is one of them, get this idea that on election night, we could get better data than anybody in the world about what's going on in the voting. And that, you know, everybody will get their election results from the television set. But the television set, by the standards of high-frequency trading, moves like molasses. You know, it's like their commercials. The guy who's telling you what just happened in Florida has to walk across a set. And it's audacious. Sam and a couple of others orchestrate the scheme where they assign a trader to each state, and their job is to suck in the polling data as quickly as they can get it and turn it into trading decisions. So good news for Trump during the night, short the markets. Bad news for Trump, by the markets. And there are five or six turning points during the election. In the end, results come in from the Florida panhandle. They have them before everybody else, which if you think about this is breathtaking, that a Wall Street firm who is trading on it is able to find out what's just happened in a presidential election before anyone else
on
the planet.
How are they doing this?
They're doing it by just going to the raw sources where the data is available. Like the data.
So in the counting centers in Miami-Dade, or yeah. They're going to the actual
They're going
place.
To the website. The moment the data is available, they take it.
Okay.
And it isn't going word of mouth up to the guy at CNN. It's right into their trading systems. And it works like a charm. And when Sam goes home at night, it is the most profitable trade in the history of Jane Street. 6 hours later, the markets in the U.S. have recovered dramatically.
So even though Trump won, they said this might not be so bad.
It's like we're going to cut taxes. We're going to like it's okay. it was horrible for like the Mexican stock market, but it was great for the U.S. stock market. And so Sam comes back as the trader has lost the most money in the history of Jane Street, and he's sort of largely or partly responsible for it. They don't blame him, but he has an argument with the firm, and the argument is we were that close. We should be doing this in an even bigger way going forward. And the Jane Street bosses say, we didn't know what we were doing. that we didn't know the trade to put on. We would get the information better, but we didn't know how to react to that kind of information. And Sam is disillusioned by that. He wants to take more risk than Jane Street will take. And at the same time...
But haven't the boss just said to you, Sam, you may well take more risk, but you were wrong?
Yeah, that's right.
And the market is all about being right or wrong. Yep. It's not about morality, whether you thought it...
But the way they think of it is the process, there was something right about the idea. They didn't blame him. They were just like, this was very clever. You know, it cost us $300 million. But this tells you something about Sam Bankman-Fried, that his response to this, we should do more...
Should double down.
Double down. And they say no, and he's already thinking, this place isn't big enough for my ambition. And at the same time, crypto has just exploded.
Yes.
Crypto has gone from being, you know, whatever it was, some billions of dollars to trillions of dollars. And it's the one market where these high-frequency traders have not got to.
Okay.
So his idea is, I'm going to be Jane Street for crypto. And we're going to do it, we got to go move fast because Jane Street's soon going to be the Jane Street for crypto. So we're going to get there first.
So he's not a crypto evangelist at any stage.
He didn't know what it was.
He didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
He doesn't believe it's going to be the future of money. He doesn't believe it's going to do this, that, and the other. He says, this is a space that I can apply my talents and make much more money than I could anywhere else.
That's right.
Okay.
The expected value, it's always an expected value calculation of my life, goes up here if I leave Jane Street and go to do this.
But there is a comic dimension to the whole thing. There's a farcical dimension.
There's a farcical dimension, and this is an example of it. There were times when I thought this book I'm writing is Ferris Bueller's Day Off. It's not Bernie Madoff. And so Ferris Bueller moves to Berkeley, California, and he starts a hedge fund with no one but effective altruists, but virtually none of whom have any experience trading anything. And they raise $175 million from other effective altruists on Sam's theory that we're going to be Jane Street for crypto. And then he just starts trading maniacally. And he's discovered that he's not best at chess. He's best when chess is semi-chaotic. And he needs to be in these semi-chaotic environments. And so he creates them over and over. And he does it instantly in this new hedge fund. He's built this machine that will make 250,000 trades a day in the crypto markets on 50 different crypto exchanges, arbitraging small price differentials from place to place without having any accounting, anybody who knows about trading. At the end of 6 weeks, they don't know, they've lost track of 30% of the trades. And his fellow effective altruists are pointing out that, like, you've lost all this money. And it isn't lost like he lost it in bets. It's lost. Like, they don't know where it is. And
we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars.
Well, in this case, that he had a couple of hundred million, but there was $4 million of a crypto coin that just vanished. And they couldn't figure out what had happened to it.
So then he's trading this hedge fund, and he figures out, I can't make enough doing this, but I'll set up an exchange, and I'll take other people's money.
Yep.
So, because this is when it all starts to get...
Well, so it's a little more complicated. What happens is the hedge fund does very well for a while, and then sure enough, Jane Street and the others start coming into the markets. And he's looking for other ways to make money. So he doesn't actually think, I want to start an exchange. He says, I want to create a better technology for an exchange. All these crypto exchanges have big problems. They're all kind of bulky. And we're going to create a better one, but I can't do it. And none of the exchanges take him up on it. None of them want it. So he's kind of backed into a corner, we'll do it ourselves, and is incredibly anxious for the next 6 months because he can't imagine himself as like this carnival barker in the middle. It turns out that the world is ready to have Sam Bankman-Fried as a carnival barker. So that's how FTX starts, again, kind of accidentally. And within a year, it's clear they're sitting on a gold mine. He's kept his hedge fund, but alongside is this, in the same room, is this other business, this crypto exchange, on which the hedge fund trades.
This is where the story becomes part of the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
In the beginning, we're talking about an unusual guy in finance, but now we're talking about a global pandemic and a global movement into this new product, let's say.
That's right.
So, Michael, over your 25, 30 years documenting finance, ups and downs, characters, etc., what would you say the lessons from FTX, crypto, Sam himself, and where we are now, where you have this sort of the crypto trial of the decade going on in New York City as we speak?
Yeah. Regulators are so important. Grown-ups are so important. I mean, the one takeaway is like this whole sector needs to be regulated. I mean, the finance really only works properly if it's properly regulated. Even ordinary finance right now is not properly regulated. So that's like one obvious takeaway. Sam, male overconfidence is such a problem.
Male overconfidence.
Men just have this problem. You know, there are all these studies that show that when you ask little boys how they did on the math test, they all think they did better than they actually did. And you ask little girls, they all think they did worse. That this just extends itself through life. And Sam had it in spades. He just like thought he knew more than he did all the time. And he thought no one else knew anything. And the problem was he did know quite a bit. So he had evidence for a while that he was right. And it led him down a path in his mind that was insane. It led him to a kind of insanity. So that's part of the story. There is a part of the story that, you know, part of what I try to do is just tell the story and let the reader figure out what it means. And it's going to be very interesting to see how the various responses that come from this. But I find this moving through life without actual feeling, this denatured quality, which is on the rise in our world. He rhymes with Elon Musk. He's different, but he rhymes with him. This lack of a moral sense, that's maybe not the right word. The lack of emotional connectedness to other people. We live in a world where that person can get to great places and cause a lot of damage. And when I thought of Sam, one of the breadcrumbs in the story, I wonder whether people will pick up on it, is he felt to me like one version of artificial intelligence dystopia. And the version is that one of the fears with artificial intelligence is you give it an instruction, but you don't tell it how to execute it. You tell it to do something, but you don't give it guardrails. You say, get me a table tomorrow night at my favorite restaurant. And it goes out and sees the restaurant's fully booked and so starts murdering people who have reservations. This is Sam. This is Sam. It's like he had a thing and do this, no guardrails. And crypto had no guardrails. You know, he was in a world where there were no guardrails and he was raised without guardrails. And so that part of the story, it feels like that's what we're seeing here. We're seeing like that kind of thing. And so what is that? That's a denatured intelligence. And I think part of the story is about the dangers of a denatured intelligence.
Michael, I think this is probably the best way to end this on the lessons. I hadn't expected you to talk about these, but they are the lessons. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll leave it there. Michael Lewis, ladies and gentlemen.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
There you have it, John. Male overconfidence.
Yes, indeed. And just to remind you, there is the full over hour long interview, which
is really good.
Fantastic. And he actually tells a story about he was considering, when he was arrested, he was considering offering Donald Trump, I think it was $5 billion.
To go away
and not to run for president.
Yeah.
You have to listen to it all. It's fantastic.
And again, Lewis is one of the great, great storytellers. Mm. Really, really great storytellers. Michael Lewis, if you haven't read him, his first book years ago was about the trading floor of Solomon Brothers. Just brilliant, brilliant stuff. And having worked on one of those trading floors, I kind of really engaged with it because I remember the characters. And what he's making the point there, and I think it's a really interesting point, is when I worked in that business years and years ago, it was a very human business.
Yeah.
So it was basically like, imagine Moore Street in a trading floor, right? That's exactly what it was. And all the traders were kind of apples and pears.
Sure, you get your bangers.
Yeah, bangers. But they were East End lads, right? In London. Usually the kids of market stall traders, right? So they're trading, and it was real loads and loads of banter. That's when I got the nickname, which remember I told you.
Semtex.
Yeah. It was terrible. When I was working in London, I was the only Irish person on the floor, and I got the nickname, and it wasn't Paddy or Mick. It was Semtex. But the point is that finance back then was a very human business. It was about buying and selling to other humans, right? Now, with high-frequency trading, algorithms do all the trading. So a new type of individual has emerged. And I think what Lewis analyzed there is very, very interesting. It's a type of person, a very maths brain person is emerging, right? This is leading to what I would describe as extreme maleness, right? And you see it a lot. And this leads to overconfidence. You remember years ago we talked about the Dunning-Kruger effect, right?
The Dunning-Kruger effect, the fellow with the lemons.
Fellow with the lemons. Go back and have listened to it. There's a podcast we did on Dunning-Kruger, which is basically about how the truly incompetent overestimate their competence.
Yeah.
But there's also another version of that, which is that those who are always told they're great can never really accept that they might be wrong about something.
Yeah.
And again, I think Bankman-Fried falls into that sort of category.
Absolutely, he does. And, when you listen to Michael there talk about the story of when he was at this party with Blair and the Clintons and the Kardashians and all these guys, and they were all around.
That's a lot of Kardashians, Kardashians.
And that story of Anna Wintour as well.
Yeah.
And of course, there's all these people going, you're great, that's going to mess with your head. And he's going to take that on board, take it at face value, going, I am good.
I am good. So there is the personal, but there's also, let's come back and look at the historical, economic and finance of this. This is a boom bust story.
Yeah.
This is the Anglo-Irish Bank. This is the Sean Fitzpatrick of that world, right? The crypto world. And there's a commonality between all these sorts of episodes. And you don't necessarily have to have just male overconfidence. And you don't necessarily have to have what he would call this unnatural intelligence, this unemotional intelligence, lots and lots of incredibly emotionally well-balanced people get involved in this because it's greed and fear.
Yeah.
It's greed and fear. And I was contemplating this in the Dart yesterday, John, because I knew we were doing this and I was, the Dart here, and we've told the story before, but it's well worth talking about it, right? That the commonality between these boom busts usually starts with a new technology, right? So there's excitement over a new technology, right? In this case, it was crypto.
Yeah.
And then what you get is you get people becoming excited, becoming investors, betting the house. The price goes up. The more the price goes up, the more they think they're geniuses because the price goes up in itself is evidence to them that they're right. They get more people enlisted and suddenly you have a bubble, right? So this is the same sort of thing. But I was thinking about it on the Dart. Did you ever hear of a fellow called John Sadler?
No, go on.
So John Sadler committed suicide on Hampstead Heath in 1856, right? He was an independent, Irish Independent Party MP, right? So for Parnell's party before Parnell, right?
Mm.
And he also had set up an amazing bank in Tipperary called the Tipperary Joint Stock Bank.
Right.
Which was one of the most successful banks in Ireland in the 1840s.
Right.
Now, I want to tell you all about this guy, right?
Because
this is the Bankman-Fried of Irish history, right?
Okay.
So I was on the Dart. Now, we've told listeners before, but it's well worth reminding us that the train line between Dunleary, where we live, and Westland Row in town is the oldest commuter train in the world.
Yes.
Okay?
Yeah.
It was opened in 1834 by the Kingstown and Dublin Railway Company.
Yes.
Right? William Dargan, the man who built canals and also things.
He was amazing.
He was the engineer who built it, right? It was the very first ever commuter train. And all of Dunleary that you see now was built because of that.
Mm.
So people came out to Dunleary and was the first suburb ever.
Yeah.
Real suburb. Like, before there were suburbs in London.
This was a holiday town as well.
It was a holiday town, right? But it was all due to the fact that the railway was the first railway. Mm. How were those railways financed? They were all financed with private money. And in the 1830s and 1840s, you got this massive railway mania. So a bit like crypto, it was a new technology that was going to change the world, right? That you could go from A to B, and it did change the world, right? But Britain and Ireland got involved in what was called the railway mania. Now, there had been a thing, John, called the Bubble Act. You will like this, right?
The Bubble Act
was an act of Parliament in Westminster, which was initiated in 1725 after the South Sea Bubble.
Ah, Jonathan Swift.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So we're back with Swift, right? So 1725, after the fallout of the South Sea Bubble, where people lost their shirts, there was a thing called the Bubble Act was introduced in England, which meant that new speculative companies could only have 5 shareholders, right? So they couldn't basically sell bullshit to everybody else. Yeah. This was rescinded in the 1830s. So suddenly you got the opportunity to change the way things were financed. You add on top of that the railway shares. People got completely obsessed with railway shares. They went through the roof. Darwin lost his shirt and all sorts of people lost their shirt. But Sadler, our friend, is in Tipperary and he's thinking, right, a little bit like crypto. There's a boom going on. How do I get my hands on money in order to speculate on railway shares? I'll set up a bank. So he sets up a bank, right? And he's an MP, so he's a very well-regarded fellow. Okay. He sets up a bank. He takes in money from depositors. He also takes in money from shareholders. Well, people who deposit money in banks don't realize that you're just lending money to a speculative organization.
Yeah.
That's all you're doing when you deposit, right? And if you are a shareholder, you're doing the same thing. And of course, what he does is exactly what Bankman-Fried does. He just trousers all the money and bets on railway shares all around the world, in France, in Germany, Sweden, right? And again, as long as railway prices are going up, like crypto going up.
So it was okay for a while.
Yeah, as long as crypto's going up, he's a genius. He's sitting around, maybe he didn't sit around with baggy shorts and a T-shirt talking to Tony Blair. The same sort of carry on, right? He was a member of Parliament, right? So he was knocking around with all these bigwigs. And of course, the minute the railway shares start to fall, everybody panics. So the people who were giving him money yesterday look for the money back today.
Yeah, got the margin call.
Got the margin call. Of course, our friend John Sadler has no money.
Yeah.
And the extraordinary entitled Tipperary Joint Stock Bank goes bust with liabilities of about 37 million euros in today's money.
Right.
And Sadler takes his own life because of the shame of the whole thing. And of course, at the time, there was no limited liability. So it meant if you were a shareholder, you were on the hook for everything. So right now, because of limited liability, so limited liability is a way to ensure that shareholders' downsides are limited. Mm. So there's a limited liability. But that is a reasonably modern concept. So back then, all the shareholders were on the hook. You might have remembered years ago, when we were living in London, there was a crisis in Lloyd's, the insurance company.
Yes.
And there were a thing called Lloyd's Names.
For ages.
Lloyd's Names, right? Yeah. And these were all these kind of posh people who were actually had unlimited liability to the downside and the upside of Lloyd's and they lost their fortune. So interestingly, I think the takeaway isn't just male overconfidence, isn't just this unnatural, unemotional brain. I think it's part of the story. But I think what we're here, John, is it's as old as the hills, this story, right?
Yeah.
It's that every time there is speculation, every time there is leverage, every time there is a new technology, every time there is effervescence and a bubble, we get exactly the same thing happen. And at the end of all these episodes, you have swindlers, you have crimes, you have white-collar crime, and this is just one of them. And Bankman-Fried is the latest, but not the last, in a long line of fellas who put their hands in other people's pockets, take their money, speculate. Everyone thinks they're a genius. Do you remember here, Anglo-Irish Bank? Oh, they're geniuses. Yeah, they're fantastic. Yeah. There's new Irish banking. It was just a Ponzi scheme. Exactly the same thing here, except they're betting on tokens, not office blocks.